Hello and welcome to another episode of Transformational Blueprints, where we try to put a dent in the large number of transformation programs that fail. Hosted by me, Mario Michaels, founder and director of Synaxia Group. On this series, we will bring you unique insights drawn from first-hand experience from some of the most high-profile architecture and transformation leaders across the globe. Topics told in order to share knowledge, experiences, and ideas to inspire, innovate, and give back to the architecture community. So grab a coffee, sit back, and relax. Tawhid, welcome very much to the pod. Today we're going to be talking about a number of things, but you know, I suppose one key thing is working for a private equity backed business and how that is different within an architecture setting. So just to give everybody a bit of an outline, Tawhid is known to be a pragmatic and results oriented professional with a rare mix of skills across business, IT and ops. He operates and has advised at CIO, CDO, CTO and also COO levels for businesses ranging from startups, scale-ups and large enterprises, and brings to them strong commercial acumen coupled with a passion for innovation in data, digital and AI. So a varied, varied experience in size of business, operating levels, etc., etc. Tawhid, welcome to the pod. If you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about yourself, Tawhid, your career and how you got to where you are.
Lovely to be here. Thank you, Mario. I think you've covered all ground. Those are exactly all the things I say when I introduce myself. So I'm currently chief architect for a non-life, you know, commercial specialties insurer. We operate in the B2B segment, so most of our clients are in fact brokers or large corporates. My background, I guess, mostly across, I'd say, 15-ish years in consulting and telecoms prior to that. So I think I started off with web development, database development. Everyone, if you build something back in those days, you were a developer. Now you're an engineer. But it started off there and then gradually moved towards systems analysis and enterprise architecture, closer to business. And most of my experience, I say, for more than the last decade is in financial services. So worked across, I think, all of the UK from banks, one or two fintech, asset managers, both retail and commercial insurers. So I moved more and more towards business facing roles. But at the end of the day, they were all data centric change. So
okay.
I used to describe myself as a full stack data consultant.
Okay. And you've worked in a lot of consultancies as well, some of the bigger ones as well. So we'll come on to that in a moment. But I suppose where I always like to start off the conversation, you've managed large teams, small teams, a variety of different sort of verticals. What do you think makes a great architect in today's world?
I think the way I describe it is, one, you have to understand the investment and risk appetite of the business you work in. You know, you have to appreciate that not all businesses are built to be the same. So you can't just take, you know, like something you've read on a paper that works for, let's say, a fintech or predominantly a tech company and apply that to, you know, let's say a commercial organization. So I think if you want to be a good architect, you have to understand risk and investment appetite, because that helps you tell stories better. So one of the things I do, for instance, whenever I pick up a new project, client, organization, whatever, I go through their annual report.
Yeah.
A lot of my peers would want an as-is, you know, diagram of the architecture. I go after the annual report because that tells me, you know, what the investment priorities are. Because at the end of the day, if you want to live your design, you need to find a way of, you know, creating the business case for it. So I think that's one. The second thing is it's actually a leadership principle from AWS. It's about having a bias for action. So I think gone are those days when you can sit in a team of, I don't know, 10, 20 architects and design guardrails and blueprints, frameworks, and expect that to become reality through, mm-hmm. you know, large engineering teams. Things move fast, and you, as an architect, you almost have to partner up with engineers and have a much more actionable, pragmatic way of designing solutions. And the third bit, I think, is have awareness of your ecosystem.
Okay.
So a lot of things that you might be designing, you know, to be built in a different way, someone has already done it out in the industry. So, you know, have awareness of not just, you know, the data tools or the mm-hmm. tech tools, but also the business ecosystem.
And your background is very much that of an engineer when you first started, as you said and alluded to in your introduction. Why do you think that's benefited you now as an architect or chief architect in your case?
I think I probably left engineering a good 7-8 years ago. But where I think it benefits having worked in both business and tech is it helps you tell stories. It okay. helps you create levels of abstraction. It helps you distill, you know, the complexity of a build process from the actual value that you create for the business. It helps okay. you bridge those two together. That's one, which is on the kind of engagement, communicate value. You know, the other avenue is when you have an engineering background, every time you're designing a solution, you're also thinking about the viability, the mm-hmm. ability to actually execute on it. You're not just thinking how do technologies talk to each other. You're also thinking about the skills that will be needed to bring this to life and whether your organization can attract those skills. Does it already yep. have them in-house? Are those skills you will need long-term? Yeah, so you take a multifaceted view of design. You're not just looking at how can I make this elegant. You're also thinking who's going to build it, who's going to run it. You know, do I have yep. it in-house? Is that something, you know, my company is willing to spend money on long-term? Yeah, you take a multifaceted view.
I think the blend of engineering, as you say, that multifaceted view of who's going to build it, how we're going to build it, what's the impact, etc. But then you also bring this business element to it as well, which is, yeah, we can build, you know, the greatest thing in the world, but if I know the users aren't going to use it or the customers aren't going to use it, or there's no point building it. And that's really, really hard to come by. And I think, you know, answering my own question, what makes a great architect? I think it is that multifaceted view of, yes, you need to understand what goes into building something. You also need to understand the business implications that has. And then also, what real return or what real impact is that going to have on the business and the customer side of things? And if you pull all those three together, which over the past few years, we've seen that diminish a lot, or you do get people that are too business focused and don't understand the technology that sits behind it. So yeah, as you say, bringing that multifaceted view and those skills and personalities together is absolutely vital, absolutely vital. So you touched on IQ and what they do. What's your remit? Again, just so when we're talking about the conversation, people can, I suppose, have a bit of context behind it. What's your remit at IQ as sort of chief architect there?
So I'm probably the first architect that they hired in a perm position. Previously, they, you know, we were relying on partners, consultancy, service provider, and I report into the chief operating office and the chief finance office as opposed to, you know, a pure IT architect.
Mm-hmm.
So my remit covers, I'd say, 20-30% strategy. Forget the numbers, but it covers strategy. So across an enterprise wide view, how do we combine technology, data, innovation capabilities to achieve our vision? You know, where do we make build versus buy decisions? So part of it is pure strategy. Then is govern against that strategy. So mm-hmm. implement your, you know, technical design authority,
yep.
govern the standards through which we apply controls before solutions go live and while they're being developed. Then I have a set of strategic initiatives where I will provide almost like program and project level design support.
Yep.
So these are, you know, let's say specific assets that we will invest in because it has IP value or franchise value. And then there's innovation. So how do we stay on top of emerging opportunities in the market, emerging tech plays, emerging ecosystem plays. So it covers quite broad, I guess, horizontals. And then the verticals are, we run a specialties London market business. So that covers about 15 classes of business. So we underwrite anything from aviation to cyber to floods, natural disasters, political violence.
Wow. I mean,
there's about 15, 16 of those. That's one part of the business. The other part of the business is a the commercial motor insurer, so that covers pretty much anything that runs on road that you can't get to a, you know, compare the market.
Yeah.
It's like fleets, trucks, agricultural vehicles, military equipment, taxis, police vehicles, a pretty sizable market cap we have. And then the third is our outward reinsurance business. So that's a lot more complex contracts. And then the, you know, part of that is the US market, and this is more complex. So this is like it's equivalent to saying how do you balance out your portfolio?
I mean,
it's pretty that, complex.
I was going to say that sounds pretty complex. So you joined fairly recently. What did your first 90 days look like? And just to caveat that, you're the first permanent architect the business has employed. There's clearly a remit to try and grow that as a practice, as you know, imaginable, because it sounds pretty complex. So what do you know, day one, IQ, what does the first, or what do the first 90 days look like?
Do you know what? It's gone so fast. I actually can't recall what the first 90 days looks like. I joined in September, but no, I think let me think what has worked well. So for me, context was I've joined at a time when there's different there's a very broad range of changes going through, different delivery models, different architectures, and you step back and you go, actually, you know, before I can demonstrate value of architects, I need to influence how things actually get delivered, how change gets delivered. And so in the first 90 days, a lot of my focus was embedding some level of lightweight architectural support and governance part of our change methodology. So for instance, working with procurement.
Okay.
So embedding, you know, very quickly defining what our sort of well-architected framework could look like. Usually what's worked for me is start shallow, but start broad. So start with a shallow, you know, very broad framework and get it adopted into procurement, into change committee, into steering committee. And so focus on what behaviors you need to change within people who will make you successful. So don't start deep. I think that worked well for me. So now, for instance, we have that framework embedded into procurement. So every time we sign new contracts with vendors or go through, you know, vendor selection, it's the same consistent template that goes out.
Yeah.
Whenever we, let's say, bring things into our change committee, you know, it's the same framework that you know, project managers will use and say, okay, have we assessed it again? So part of it is, you know, changing behaviors of your counterparts who will make you successful outside architecture. The second important thing I had to pick up was understand what our growth agenda is.
Yep.
And behind the scenes technical challenges that act as barriers to that growth agenda. You know, some of it happened to be on how we were managing our cloud infrastructure. So they pick that up. Some of it happens to be how we, let's say, integrate into third-party software as a service. So pick that up. And you pick these kind of behind-the-scene activities to show the value that architects can bring in, but make that visible to the business. You know, demonstrate how it reduces code plans or how it reduces cost of engineering. Or demonstrate how if you do this differently in 2024, then 2025 becomes simpler. How it makes it more secure. So all that now, at the moment now, I've got how many? One, two, three. I've got three people in my team who've joined in the last, 3 months? And then I've got another person coming in. So yeah, I mean, from zero to about five people.
In 6 months. Yeah. And you mentioned that
a lot of this is not funded through any kind of central pot. It's all funded through, you know, business areas. Right? So, you know, aligning architects not to IT domains but to business verticals, like the architect aligned to finance, the architect aligned to, you know, London market, aligned to motor, aligned to, you know, cyber, etc.
So there's three things I want to sort of delve into a little bit there. The first one is understanding the growth agenda. And you mentioned a couple of examples there. you're new to the business. How do you go about doing that? Who do you speak to? What sort of questions are you asking to really understand, to get under the nooks and crannies of that growth agenda? Because that is instrumental to, you know, that's the engine that you're going to put petrol on effectively, isn't it?
It's a good question, because there is no surefire step. So I always start with the annual report.
Yep. Okay.
You know, that tells me what the executive committee has committed to investors. I will look at, you know, email trails and identify, you know, quote unquote vocal stakeholders and try to grab coffee with them. Okay. I will try to access, you know, the change book of work that, let's say, my boss's boss will be aware of. So there are many things you could look at in your first, you know, say 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I think the lesson I've learned is it's never going to be written in black and white anyway.
Yeah.
You almost have to infer. Okay? You have to infer. You have to look at the things, the posts that, you know, the company is putting on its public website. Yeah. Those are things that the company is proud of.
Right? Yeah.
And then find ways of speaking to people behind that, because in their mind, that's probably like step one or step five things.
Yeah.
It's like I have this allergic reaction to strategy papers. Like 80% of them actually don't tell you what to prioritize.
Exactly. And that's the hard thing around it, right? You've really got to, it's like,
you will never, right?
Teeth out. So.
But you need to, what works better is, I think science, behavioral psychologists will describe this as observable behavior in the business. Observable behavior.
Observable. Okay.
Yeah. So if you can accumulate observable behavior, it tells you the culture of the business and what it values. So for instance, if you see that for some odd reason there's a part of the business that always manages to get its changes approved.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
Some part of the business that has a self-sufficient, you know, self-funded team delivering change, then that means even if it's not written on paper, someone high up in the business has given that leader the mandate to drive growth. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I identified individuals such as those.
Okay.
And made the effort to, you know, meet them face to face, build a rapport. When I learned that, okay, they're not UK based, you know, find time through their PAs, build the connection. And then that's when you learn that, you know, here's how they're trying to grow. As an architect, my opportunity is that half an hour.
Yeah.
That half an hour is the opportunity to say, you have to almost get out of your architect comfort zone. So you almost have to get into, I saw you, you know, you're doing this. Have you considered, you know, how X will happen, Y will happen?
Yeah.
Don't lead with fear. Don't lead with fear. Lead with things like, how do your teams, you know, run their FP&A today?
Mm-hmm.
You guys use this? Oh, you should be off something better, right? And then they'll say, oh yeah, we've been trying to do this, but we didn't get anyone, you know, to approve. And that's when you can.
Don't worry, I'll do that for you.
Yeah.
That's it. You've got to go in there, as you say. Don't go in it with fear, but go in it with, right, I'm here to help you. My job is purely to serve and help you make your job easier, so you can do whatever their end objective is, whether that is close more sort of deals, raise more corporate finance, whatever it is. And earlier on, you mentioned how you've brought in four or five architects in the past sort of 6 months, and you've aligned them to business areas. Tell us a little bit about how that works, because that's quite unique.
So it depends on the way change is funded in a business.
Okay.
And the net value, you know, different sponsors across the business, the architects bring in.
Okay.
If the mindset is, you know, we need a central team of architects to make sure we're doing things safely, then chances are you will need a large central budget.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a large central budget, then those architects would be all aligned to IT domains. So you'll have a network architect, a security architect, you know, data, information, you know, infrastructure, etc. Yeah. But if the business perception is, if we get architects on our project, then they help build things in a way that gets us to move faster, spend lesser on third party, and, you know, it helps next year's agenda better, right? Then they'd be more than happy to bring those architects, you know, a portion, some of this year's budget for next year's games. Yeah. If you're able to, you know, land into that sphere, then A, you're able to influence the business better. But the downside is finding T-shaped architects is more hard.
Absolutely. Yeah,
because then you have to bring people who can operate at an enterprise level. They have at least two areas of specialization. So, you know, either they really understand data and, you know, analytics value chain, but not so much infra, or maybe they understand infra and network, but not so much, let's say, application development. So one of the things I did was look through my kind of biggest changes that are planned, and, you know, finger in the air, you know, where is the quantum of the architect work needed? Where I saw, okay, X amount of projects, it's not core infra change, but the data needs to be good.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and out for T-shaped architects, but with the specialization in data, versus a group of projects here, which are fundamentally legacy infra change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, go after a T-shaped architect who knows insurance, but, you know, domain focus is infra.
Yeah.
So setting up that team is a lot harder than setting up your classic, you know, art team. But it pays better returns because then I don't need large central budgets.
Yeah. Makes absolute sense. I love it. Yeah.
And the business team value what they bring in, right?
Yeah. And they're able, because they're sat within the business areas, they're able to build close relationships, which means they're able to understand their end user or their client, which is, you know, the internal stakeholders, better.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately you're then striving for the same goal, whereas I think, you know, and architects have been known to be called ivory tower architects because they're sat all the way over here and they don't know what we're doing on a day-to-day basis, and it's really hard to demonstrate value, and we'll come on to that in a second. But one area you touched on earlier during the introduction, you report into the COO and a dotted line into the CFO. That is really, really unusual. What's the, for a chief architect, by the way, usually a CTO or CIO would do, or they'd be peers on the board and architecture is aligned into technology. What's the thought process behind this?
So I think part of it might have been logistical, because we have a acting head of IT, an interim role.
Yep.
And so, you know, when we ran through the interview processes, maybe I appeared as someone who, you know, cares about how a business operates beyond the tech it brings in. So I don't know the rationale that they had behind the scenes. From my perspective, I think it's down to the segment of the market we operate in, Mario.
Okay.
So we are not a retail business.
Okay.
We don't have, you know, 40 million customers.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
We're a low volume, but high value, high complexity business.
Yeah.
And so for an architect, what that means is, don't be naive that you can build one thing and it will work for every customer.
Yeah.
Like if I've got 17 classes of business on one side, I've got 7 classes of motor on the other side, I've got, you know, reinsurance work on the other side, I could never design one IT architecture that works for everything.
Yeah.
So go on.
I was going to say, surely that makes your job a bit more difficult when because they all have to align to something, and all these different areas, surely they've got to align to some area of technology, bringing it all back into a central area. Difficult to articulate what I'm trying to say, but, you know, if you've got that over there, that over there, that over there, how do they all talk to each other?
Well, technically they don't.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But
is that purposeful?
Well, I think it's impractical.
Yeah.
I think it's impractical. So for instance, you know, because I don't have, you know, 20 million customers who between them share 5 different profiles, it's impossible for me to think that all of that customer data will be in one lakehouse.
Okay.
Yeah. It's impossible for me to think I'll have one engine that provides these 25 classes of business the insights that they need. Right. So you almost have to take a domain oriented approach and go, Okay. So this particular domain, how does that work? This particular domain, how does that work? You know, you might have a submissions domain, you know, risk domain, a broker domain, etc. The thing that you can bring back together are things like, how do they connect to our network? How do they classify data?
Yeah.
How do I manage access into third-party systems? Those things you can centralize.
Yeah.
You can centralize orchestration, you can centralize integration hubs. But the classic things that people usually centralize, it's like, okay, this is our default framework for building digital apps. So that ain't working. Right?
Yeah,
like
we've
got like 1,400 brokers, of which, you know, they're like 7 different varieties, and then software houses. So the more I think about it, the thing that needs to be aligned is the operational strategy. Is how do you operate the business? Yeah, guardrails around what do you build versus what do you buy? Guardrails around what are your assets that you attach product value to?
Yeah.
To me, those aren't technology decisions.
Yep. Yeah. Makes absolutely technology's the tool or the enabler to make that happen, rather than we're focusing everything around technology. And do you, I suppose, you know, really blunt question, but is it working reporting into a COO and dotted line into a CFO? Do you, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
You're definitely one step closer to the chief exec.
Yeah.
Right. You're definitely one step closer to, you know, those growth agendas, those business plans. You're one step closer to, let's say, strategic contracts that we want to make with partners. I think this is probably something a lot of senior enterprise architects, I guess, don't have the advantage of. When they don't have that visibility, because, you know, I've come across lots of really good architects during my time who say, if only I had known this 3 months ago, I wouldn't have, you know, wasted my time designing X.
Yeah. Fine. Okay. And again, earlier on, you mentioned an interesting sort of ideology around how your team is ecosystem led, and you come from you do architecture and ecosystem led rather than engineering led. What does that mean? If you wouldn't mind going, and what are the benefits, I suppose, to it?
Yeah, so this makes me seen as a controversial.
Great, we like
in,
it
in my peers. So I think it, so my views depend or are based largely on the market segment in which you operate. Like I said, if we were a fintech, yeah, then maybe not so much ecosystem led. Maybe, I don't know, if you were a retail bank, I think ecosystem led means you keep an eye on ecosystem partners. You keep an eye on capabilities that are more likely to become commoditized before you embark on building them. So I'll give you some numbers as an example. Right? So have you kept up to speed with the MAD landscape?
No, I haven't.
So,
I'm afraid.
So MAD landscape is machine learning, artificial intelligence, and data landscape. There's a landscape that gets published every year.
Okay.
And it shows, you know, how many companies operate in that space of machine learning, AI, data, etc. I was looking at the 2021 landscape versus 2023 landscape. In 2 years alone, there's been a new addition of more than 300 companies globally.
Right.
Yeah. The total number now, I think, is 1,416. So looking at OpenAI stats, in the last 12 months alone, I think now the number is over 900 companies using OpenAI for building new products for their customers, right? So when I say ecosystem-led rather than engineering-led, what I mean is if you have a good appreciation of the talent in your company, the speed at which you can build products, and compare that with, you know, your ecosystem around you, and take time to go through each different capability like customer engagement, risk management, you know, blah, blah. You'll soon realize that there are segments where the ecosystem can churn out products a lot quicker than you can.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's no longer then about the speed at which you can build capability, but more the speed at which you can integrate with commoditized
other things, yeah, other systems, yeah, yeah. Yeah, right, like that's
other,
really, really
other
interesting.
People will build things a lot quicker than you could. And this happens in my case because a lot of companies I work for aren't necessarily tech companies. They try to portray that, we're a tech company that does insurance.
Yeah.
We're an insurance company, right?
Yeah, that uses technology.
Like, that uses technology to its advantage. So for us, you know, keeping sight of what's readily available.
Yeah,
it's super important for speed.
Doesn't that encourage the magpie effect, though? And, you know, architects in particular, and engineers even more so, actually, love the next shiny thing that's coming out. So creating that ecosystem-led environment, surely that encourages, there's a new company there that are doing that. We could really do with that. Bang, let's go full steam ahead. And then, as you say, realize in 6 months' time, we probably didn't do a full scoping exercise and there's another business actually that was better for us and so on. Because as you say, there's a new business popping up, new technology business popping up every sort of couple of days at the moment.
Oh, so I'm referring to both the tech businesses as well as the tech-enabled business ecosystem.
Fine.
So
okay.
For instance, let's say you're underwriting aviation. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're underwriting property and natural catastrophe, right?
Yeah.
You're more likely to find people, companies that have built AI embedded applications for your very use case that you can plug
right.
into.
But fine.
But you're right. It doesn't overcome the magpie effect. You're more likely to find, here's the new shiny toy. So part of that you can manage by having sort of managed innovation.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, you know, every year we allocate X amount of funds for experimenting and innovating, and here's the criteria that they need to pass to tap onto that funding, and here's the criteria they need to pass. So we put them into production and think about it seriously. The other way you control that risk is by having clarity of your financial budgeting cycle. So for instance, if you're a private equity backed business, you need to demonstrate value every 2-3 years.
Yep.
So as long as you pick something that allows you to move fast and you can show return in those 2-3 year period, it's fine. If in year 4 you go, it was a bad idea. You know,
right.
Let's move to something else.
Okay.
Yeah, because you've shown value to investors.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? You've tried something, tested it. Even if it doesn't work, it might not work because, you know, the market has moved on, or the, you know, end users' requirements have changed.
And IQ are a private equity backed business, and you've already said there how that might change your thought process. So how do you demonstrate value of architecture in a quicker cycle within what private equity firms expect, really? As you say, it's a 2-3 year cycle max. How do you demonstrate value that quickly?
Not taking 6 months to write a strategy.
Ship it. Just do it.
So I think mentally you need to have the strategy, but you don't want to hold people back.
Yeah.
And wait for something. So I think for me, it's plugging yourself into projects and programs, not sitting in that ivory tower. That's got to be number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I think, is you architect for speed and flexibility without compromising security and compliance. Those two are the main ones. So you don't necessarily architect for scale, or volume that your business doesn't need.
Yeah.
So like of the 6-7 things architects care about, you have you kind of pick your corner.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So for instance, if you're architecting for speed, you know, you might say to projects that, okay, you know, I'll approve working with engineering to stand up a separate environment where you can build your demo, but you need to give me funding so I can create the Node.js environment for you. But as an architect, what you're controlling is the language that they use.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, let's say your integration hub only supports Node, so you can't then allow a project team to start writing up its app in Python. You know, hypothetical example, right? So So you have to get down at the engineering level, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is not. There's no room for theory.
Exactly that. Yeah, because the investors do want their money back and they want it quick. So yeah, I get that. And you briefly touched on sort of your background and the AI side and the machine learning side of within the data element. What's your process of, you know, at a really high level, this is, by the way, let's not get into detail, but what's your process of developing an AI strategy? Because again, we are at risk of businesses being magpied, so to speak. AI, the new shiny thing, new kid on the block. How do we really, govern's probably the wrong word because govern has a negative connotation to it around being really risk adverse and so on, but
yeah,
you have to be risk adverse with AI, right? So how do you, you know, make it less sexy, I think, when we've spoken about it in the past, you've said.
This is a topic that I think I got recognized within my peer well before sort of ML ops or generative AI was in the market. Because I think by recollection, I've probably put four sort of machine learning based models or AI based models into live production and benefits realized. Mm-hmm. And across the industry, we're still at that sort of rate of 10-15% projects actually go to that. Yeah, so that must mean I've probably dumped in 30-40 POCs. Right? So more failures than success.
Yeah, than successes. Yeah.
I think companies writing AI strategy. I think. So I'm co-authoring ours. So I think ignore the word AI for a second.
Yeah.
And just look at sort of your company's goals, vision, whatever, and find opportunities of how AI can help achieve those outcomes. So for instance, if you've got, you know, like a 5-pillar or 6-pillar business vision that says, okay, we're going to do this for people, this for customers, this for growth, this for, you know, cost simplification, this for blah, blah, blah. Identify, you know, a handful of use cases across those, because that explains to the business the net value of doing so. I think the AI strategy starts from that point onwards, which is saying, okay, of these, I don't know, 20 use cases, how many different vehicles do I have? What delivery patterns do I have? Because not all AI is the same. Yeah. For some people, AI is just a little bit more sophisticated, unsupervised machine learning.
Yep.
For some people, it is, you know, agents who are training other large language models.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For some people, it is AI embedded in other systems that you buy. Right. So,
yeah,
like your patterns aren't the same. And for some people, it's just using Copilot.
Yeah.
So spin up maybe four of these type of delivery vehicles against those use cases and then try to find, okay, what's the biggest coverage I can get with the minimum spend? That is strategy, in my opinion. It's how you maximize your resources, your time, your money, and get the best value for the buck. The issue I have with majority of strategy papers I read, they're very democratic and very flat. You can't pick it up and say, okay, what do you want? What are you okay for me not to do?
Yeah. Right?
Like they're too flat. They don't show a sense of prioritization.
Yeah.
That AI strategy should say, here's the level of investment we will make by buying things. Here's areas where we will wait and for the market to evolve. Here's the things that we definitely see an advantage of being the first in the market to launch, and therefore we'll do it as an experiment.
Yep.
That is what I think AI strategy needs to cover. It's those different delivery vehicles against use case, some sense of prioritization. And then you get into very quickly into execution and say, okay, we can polish this theory.
Mm-hmm.
We can get more forensic about it. We can bring consultants in and, you know, build this 20 list to 100 list.
Yeah.
But how do we get this into action? And if the action means your basic data governance is missing, you can't even classify data to say which one I'm allowed to run an AI model on, then okay, come back in 6 months. or if you don't have basic integration capability or basic event oriented capability, or you can't even spin up a sandbox environment on your cloud tenant, come back in 6 months' time.
Yeah, makes absolute sense.
Between that time, you know, build out your kind of runways, and then keep an eye on, let's say, you know, third party labs or third party vendors. You know, just
the executive got a big part to play in it as well, haven't they? Because it's really easy to get drawn into that as, you know, somebody who doesn't come from a technology background. Oh, we're hearing AI can do this. We're hearing AI can do that. How about we do it? We could probably do it. So there's a lot of pressure on, you know, architects and, you know, the technology function to implement AI when it's actually not needed. As you say, it's just about, right, what's the business objectives? Can AI help? What's our current ecosystem? And does AI or this particular AI tool help us achieve where we're trying to get to, rather than we're using AI for using AI's sake? Great. Okay. So we're coming towards the end now, Tawhid, of our chat. And I always ask sort of four or five quick fire questions. So here we go. So question number one, what do you look for when you're building a team?
I think we may have covered this. So look at, do they have a bias towards action?
Mm-hmm.
So can they move from design into execution quickly? And do they have a natural tendency of getting things done? So that's on the behavior side. Because of the way we're structuring our org, look for T-shaped individuals. And then the third, I'm always curious to see the path that they've taken. So whether they've come from an engineering background or system admin or governance, because that gives me sign of what they care about.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. If a CEO asks you for some advice, what would it be?
A CEO.
CEO, right now.
How can I help him or her maintain better alignment with the work that their different teams are doing?
Okay.
Because architects are meant to have that overarching visibility of, you know, the totality of everything that happens. So identify overlaps, identify underinvested areas, identify areas of friction. So I think one might be on how could I help the CEO execute with confidence?
Okay.
Probably going to be one. Maybe the other one is on where are there untapped opportunities in the business.
Okay, perfect. What do you expect in 2024 will be a game changer from a technology perspective?
I think further permeation, if that's the word, of generative AI into business systems. That probably is one. Another probably game changing. 2024, did you say?
Yeah. We've got 10 months left.
I think that's probably different versions of that, probably the one that comes to mind.
It's fairly unanimous across everybody.
You'll find generative AI becoming part of your software supply chain without even realizing it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what's the biggest change you expect to see in the architecture market over the next 5 years?
5 years is hard. 2 to 3 years easier to say. I think you'll see more demand for orchestration, engineering skills, more demand for API engineering skills, more demand for cyber engineering skills. So I think we've just about gone through the data engineering hype cycle or data engineering demand. So I think you'll start seeing demand elsewhere. The other thing you might see in the next 5 years is cloud service providers beefing up their quantum compute services.
Yep. Yeah.
So that you might see. And the third thing you might see is some explosion of observability tools for machine learning and AI.
Okay.
Especially when the EU AI Act and, you know, various different legislations hit the market. I think there's going to be a demand for kind of explainability, observability, model drift detection, you know, compliance tools for AI.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Tawhid. That brings us sadly to the end of our conversation. We've run out of time. So great podcast episode. So again, thank you for joining us. Been really interesting and great to chat with you in detail around a number of things, you know, architecture alignment, ecosystem led architecture, how thought process changes in a PE backed environment, So yeah, I'm really looking forward to the feedback on this one, Tawhid. Yeah, as I say, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. Cheers. And that's a wrap. Sadly, we're at the end of another Transformational Blueprints episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and there were plenty of golden nuggets for you to take away. If you're a fan of the show, please do remember to share, like and leave reviews so that more people from our industry get to hear and benefit from these too. Please also follow Synactia Group on LinkedIn to keep up to date with new episodes. Links in the show notes. Join us next time for another episode packed with tips and advice from senior leaders in the technology world.